My name is Mark Chaplin. I'm the moderator for this session. The title of the session, as you can see, is the Coppola for Issue Brief on Reserve Variability. We're going to talk about reserve variability in a very interesting way. I think the Committee on Property Liability Financial Reporting is putting out an issue brief. Is it published yet?
I believe it is available on the web. It's going to get modified ever so slightly, but it is published as of today out on the web.
Okay, so this is a very interesting and useful addition to our documentation, if you will, for lack of a better word, on this emerging issue of reserve variability, and it's intended as a guideline, and we'll give you more details on that. The panelists today are Mark Oberholzer, is director of PricewaterhouseCoopers in Philadelphia. Mark provides a wide variety of consulting services, including reserve analyses and opinions, risk transfer reviews, and litigation support. Mark currently serves as the chairperson of the American Academy of Actuaries Committee on Property Liability Financial Reporting. He also serves on the Academy's Financial Reporting Committee and Casualty Practice Council. Christy Carpine-Tabor is an assistant vice president and actuary for Safeco Insurance in Seattle. Her work encompasses corporate oversight of reserves and modeling of reserve variability. Christy is a member of the American Academy of Actuaries Committee on Property and Liability Financial Reporting. The two of them are going to review with you the details of the issue brief that's coming out. And since that probably won't take the entire hour and a half, then they've given me an opportunity to talk about reserve ranges and give you some additional things. And I think you're going to find that we're really all in agreement here. The objective is to add clarity to communication, right? And while we're going to use different terminology and some different issues and sort of explore things and push things in different directions, at the end of the day, I think we're all in agreement that we need to increase communication effectiveness. So I think Christy's starting up.
And Mark, I would imagine it would be okay if we just take questions as we go. Because I don't think we have too much material. I don't think we're going to push the time limit today, so I think it just might be easier for us to take questions as we go. And if things get bogged down or whatever, we'll cut it off and move it on.
Morning or good afternoon, everybody. There's some seats up in front here. Don't be shy. Whoa. Not that scary. I really am not. All right. Get organized. So 2 years ago at the CLRS in Atlanta, the room was packed when Ralph Blanchard talked about reserve ranges. It was so packed. There were people out the door, and I got to go in because I actually went in and sat on the floor in the middle of the aisle. You know you really have a hot topic when the room is packed like that. So let me give you some of the backdrop that led up to that. But just so you know, that presentation, were any of you at that presentation when Ralph spoke on reserve ranges? Yeah, that's the basis for this paper. So you may hear basically some same themes again and again from that presentation. What was happening, the inspiration for that, was that about 2003, 2004, the SEC started getting very interested in reserve disclosures. And Andrea Sweeney from Coppola and Ralph Blanchard went to speak to the SEC, and they did a presentation on reserve disclosures. And what happened was that – I'm going to forward my slide here for a minute. What happened was is that in 2004, the SEC gave a bunch of comments to a bunch of companies. Probably every company got a comment letter on improving very specifically how they wanted them to improve their reserve disclosures. After that, I think actually, you know, after presenting, that's when the disclosures came out. And then what happened in 2006, a bunch of companies got another round of comment letters. And those comment letters specifically asked for underlying assumptions and calculating carried reserves, They wanted to know about potential variability in reserves, and they wanted to know specifically about the degree of conservatism, including what provisions were made for uncertainty in carried reserves. So it was in that backdrop that Ralph packed the room. Everybody had, a lot of people had received those letters, and how do we respond to this with reserve ranges? A lot of us, like I said, we had a Koppelfer meeting the next day. We walked in and said, hey, Ralph has got a really good handle on what some of the issues are and communicating ranges, because this is something we really need to get better at. And so we actually deputized Ralph into Koppelfer, and he wrote the first draft of this paper. Now, we've had many rewrites since, but that's really the basis of this paper. Our hope that the paper is going to assist actuaries in identifying the issues and communicating ranges, and will actually lead to improved disclosures in this in this area. Okay. Some logistics is the issue brief, as we were talking about, it's almost there. I don't know, there's some punctuation and some formatting. If you go to the Academy website, you will find it. I see we don't have the link on here, but within the next few days, I'm sure there'll be an email blast that will send out, you know, where you can see the paper. So because most of you have not, has anyone read the paper? Has anyone found it and read it yet? Okay, good. So obviously Mark has. So basically for today, we want to give you an overview on just a flavor for what's in the paper and what are the kind of ideas we want to get across. The topic is reserve ranges, as I said, but again, the focus is on how we as actuaries communicate, the audiences for actuaries, but we wrote it knowing that there would be other non-actuaries reading it. So it's written in a very readable format. There's nothing really technical here. If you looked at the pandas on your, you know, on this talk, there were three pandas. It's not a three panda talk. You could have come in here with the one panda. So it's pretty simple. There's also an appendix in the back that talks about the interaction of uncertainty, conservative, and bias. And this was a part of Ralph's talk, and we ended up putting it in the appendices just to have things flow a bit. So here's the structure of our talk today. We've already had an introduction. We're going to talk about the purpose and use of ranges, common types of ranges, distribution of possible outcomes, range of reasonable estimates, issues in communicating ranges and transparent disclosure, and then again, issues of conservatives and bias when you're selecting a point within a range. Ranges and distributions add great value in communicating. What we want actuaries to do is try to understand what are the intended as well as unintended uses of your disclosure. I think too often we know what we're talking about, but our users, and maybe even our users know what we're talking about, but someone from the outside, an auditor, or if it's in a publication, don't always know what we're talking about. So being aware of those two things, and also being aware of what kind of range you're using and really describe that kind of range. So I'm going to give you some examples of some ranges. If you're, you know, it's the last day of the session, right? You know, and you're probably bored. So if you're bored, you can watch the guys working on the screen there. So for risk management, you're probably it's appropriate to calculate a range of possible outcomes, including extreme scenarios. When you're looking at risk management, you want to know what's going to go bad. You want to know what's going to go really, really bad. On the other hand, you may have internal users who just want a range of reasonable estimates with some of those parameters defined around those endpoints. Let me give you an example. Your management may say, listen, we need to put up reserves for Hurricane Ike. You know, give me an estimate. And you give them an estimate. And you say, okay, you know, the high end is because of this and the low end is because of that. If you gave them a range of possible outcomes, you know, they're trying to book a point, you know. I mean, it's too much. You'll get the eye roll. So there's cases when you want to look at ranges of possible outcomes. There's cases when you want to look at ranges of reasonable estimates. For SEC filings, ranges of reasonable estimates can provide a measure of uncertainty around earnings and give the investor a sense about how much risk there is, you know, and how much judgment went into those earnings. A range of possible outcome can be viewed as a statement of risk in future values of the company and those future earnings. So again, there's a need for maybe both of those types of ranges. In mergers and acquisitions, some parties want a range of possible outcomes, including worst-case scenarios and extreme values. The outcomes may be considered useful when evaluating potential deal breakers or when negotiating terms of a reserve guarantee. On the other hand, when you're doing that, they may want a range of reasonable estimates just around cash flows for the next 2 years. So, again, reasonable estimates, possible outcomes, two different types of ranges. You're very familiar probably with how external auditors come in and produce a range around unpaid claim estimates to determine whether management's booked the recorded reserves are reasonable or not. And again, you're familiar with how an appointed actuary will look to formulate a statement of opinion, will want to look at a range of reasonable estimates. So what's the theme? There are two common types of ranges of reasonable estimates and ranges of possible outcomes. The problem that we find is that it's not always very clear when you're reading an actuary's work what are they trying to capture. They do have very different meanings. So I'm going to talk a little bit about range of possible outcomes. As the slide says, it's the breadth of possible results in the claim process. But I'm going to give you a visual. How many of the people in this room know who Rodney Krebs is? Okay. He's like 6'7", would you say? Give me a range of reasonable. He's the tallest man, tallest actuary I know. And if you've ever seen him present, he does this thing on pain theory. And he reaches his arms. I can't do it because I'm really short. And I'm 5'3 on a good day. So I'll try to stand here and do it for you. He's got hands that are like this big. He reaches across the room, and he does a thing like this. Okay, that is range of possible outcomes. Range of possible outcomes. So you think of range of possible outcomes. Think of Rodney. Don't think of me. I'm too small. Think of Rodney reaching across the room. So obviously, when you want a range that large, you're looking for maybe evaluating surplus needs in ERM. And a lot of times when we get ranges of possible outcomes, and you've probably seen a lot of this, you know, at the presentations, you're going to be using statistics or simulations to generate all those possible outcomes. We put a very simple graph. We put a very simple graph in the paper. And basically to demonstrate that when you're, you know, the beauty of having a statistical distribution or creating probabilistic models and having a distribution is that you can read off probabilities against those estimates. Unfortunately, there are challenges with statistical ranges. I mean, you've got the black dogs of model risk and parameter risk, and there's a lot of people who feel that, you know, there's a lot of different ways of doing, you know, do you have the ability to quantify those? Do you have the ability to communicate to your user, you know, what you're missing if you do a distribution and you really haven't quantified model risk or parameter risk? And for that reason, for a lot of reasons, there is really no consensus right now in the actuarial community of what is really the right way to model this stuff. So there are other outcomes. I mean, excuse me, there are other approaches to do a range of possible outcomes. You can do scenario testing, where you say, like we did before, this particular thing will give you this outcome, this particular event will give you another outcome, and that can give you a range. The problem, of course, the downside is there's no probabilities associated with that. There's also problems in that you may be using data that needs to be updated, or actually if you use historical observation, you could say, I've got this endpoint and this endpoint from things that have happened to me in the past, but maybe you're paying too much attention to things that happened in the recent past, or maybe there's things that you can't even quantify. So what I guess I'm trying to say is that with ranges of possible outcomes, there's really no set answer. You have to know what the downsides are and communicate those. At this point, I'm going to turn over to Mark.
I just remembered. I have it on the screen to look at, so don't need notes. So I'm going to talk. I'm going to shift to the range of reasonable estimates. This, of course, is, as you know, very different from a range of possible outcomes. This is usually a narrower range, and it's a range that's developed using appropriate methods and alternative reasonable assumptions, that there are at least assumptions that the actuary themselves view to be reasonable. This is very commonly done by many actuaries in this room and elsewhere to prepare their statements of actuarial opinion. Of course, it's also provided. You know, many actuaries provide this in the their actuarial opinion summary that they file after the opinion, and so forth. So, you know, this is it. It's usually used for that. It can be used certainly for other purposes, but the most common purpose that we hear a reasonable range used is in the context of an actuarial opinion. The other context, I think it's fairly commonly used, is in my world, and that's in the audit support world, where we're trying to evaluate if the recorded number is reasonable in the financial statements. So, at any rate, with some of the issues around communicating ranges, one that we talked about a little bit today at the general session on ASOP 43, you know, what's the measurement objective? I think when we started writing this paper, ASOP 43 didn't yet exist, and this was something Ralph harped on at the session. And by the way, I was one of the people that didn't sit on the floor, so I never saw the session. But I did see the slides later, and Christy told me about it. But that's something that Ralph was mentioning at that session. You know, what is the measure objective? It's the best estimate. You know, best estimate of what? Is it, you know, could it be the mean, the median, the mode? You know, actuarial central estimate, which you now have defined, and so forth. So having the actual standard practice actually require the actuary to set a measurement objective is a big step in, you know, in the communication of reserve variability and reserve ranges. With reserve ranges, with reasonable ranges, you have a couple inherent points. One, the actuary is, by definition, coming up with a number that is a boundary line between what's reasonable and what is not reasonable. But, of course, that's very subjective. If you ask multiple actuaries, you're going to get, you know, multiple answers. So there's no objective boundary that you have, which takes away a little bit of the edge, I guess, in the communication of a reserve range. And, you know, this is a direct quote from Ralph. He likes to say it's clearer to discuss a range of reasonable estimates instead of saying the range of reasonable estimates. And, of course, aggregating ranges from multiple lines of business, when you are looking at distributions and statistics, there's ways you can aggregate data. When you're trying to aggregate reasonable ranges, it's much harder. You know, you might go through multiple methods and or multiple lines of business and come up with a range for each line. You need to assume some sort of covariance or whatever assumption to try to merge those and come up with an aggregate range. That's very challenging. Those of you who have ever tried it, I'm sure you'd agree, it's very challenging and very difficult to do. And the next point is how predictable. How predictable is the range that you're providing or the estimate you're providing? How much comfort do you have in the number that you're laying out there? Is it, you know, something that's reliable, or is it something that's truly speculative? Meaning, is it, you know, just because you're able to come up with an estimate of something, you know, doesn't mean that estimate is actually reliable and meaningful. So one of the items that we touch on in the paper is this example, which I think Ralph probably also brought this up at the meeting last time, but I remember this equation from watching Cosmos when I was a teenager, and I was mesmerized by Carl Sagan's voice and all that, but it was a pretty impressive show with the special effects and everything at the time. But I remember the episode where they talked about this, and I certainly didn't really get the equation. I think the answer was like there was 10 in our galaxy or something like that. There are 10 civilizations that are advanced in our galaxy, and I took it to heart. I thought, yeah, that's about right then, 10. But if you follow the math on what you have to do to get there, you're multiplying all kinds of items across that assume independence, that assume that you can actually measure the parameters and so forth. Some of them are relatively easy, and by the way, I don't remember what each of these letters are, but like the R might have been, one of the parameters was how many suns there are. We can kind of get that pretty accurately. Then how many suns have planets? Well, how off can you be, right? You can come up with some assumption there. And then it goes on further and on further and further, and some of the assumptions are how long will a civilization stay advanced before it blows itself up? Like how many years and so forth. So the end result of this was, I think, 10. But obviously there were various, you could just tweak some assumptions. They had no idea on, they completely guessed on. You could tweak those either way and get 1 or point something or 100 or 1,000 or whatever. So I thought this was a good example of that. So point with this is when you're communicating variability, when the item really has, when you really, have a lot of uncertainty with all the parameters, with all the variables and so forth, you want to make sure that that amount of uncertainty is disclosed. Because once you put a number out there, people latch onto it and take it to heart. People think of us as magicians. So you don't have them working here.
No.
Okay. Thought maybe they'd be shaking hands. I didn't notice before the other people were working when we shared this. It's like a typical guy thing, I guess. I didn't notice the details. Transparent disclosure. After the paper describes some of the basic uses of ranges, which most of it's common sense, but it's nice to read it and it puts things in perspective. We have some tips in there and some things to think about for actuaries when they're communicating ranges to people that are using the ranges. And we break these into three categories. One is to understand the perspective and of the user, or which includes the intended users and potentially unintended users. Be clear as to what type of range it is, and that just doesn't mean say it's a it's a reasonable range or a range of possible outcomes. But go further and discuss the measurement objective, how was the range created, why was it done in that way, and so forth. And finally, the reliability. The reliability of the range, how reliable are the estimates? Are they sheer speculation, like my 10 planets? Or is it something that you have much more confidence in? So a couple tips on understanding the users. One, make sure the communication is tailored to the audience involved. Just because if you're preparing a document, in a manner that another actuary can follow and you follow actuarial standards, that's not going to do much good to people that aren't actuaries, that aren't familiar with some of the things that we might take for granted. So think about the communication from the user's perspective, including potential unintended users. And address a few points. Who are the users? What experience do they have? And brainstorm about the unintended users. As to the type of range, make sure the communication that you have would address a few different points. One is the type of range. Is it a range of reasonable estimates or a range of possible outcomes? How was the range calculated? And what was the measurement objective? And why? And finally, the reliability of the estimate. So a couple questions that you want to make sure that the communication addresses. And this is a difficult one, I think, to give specific guidance on because it's so facts and circumstances specific. But how comfortable is the actuary with the reliability of the estimates that define the range or the parameters that estimate the distribution? the likelihood of outcomes outside the disclosed range is very important. A lot of times when actuaries come up with a range and put it out there, if amounts develop outside of that range, even if it's relatively likely that might happen, that surprise, it tends to surprise people. So address that up front. And does the width of the range appropriately reflect the breadth of the uncertainty given what the measurement objective is? So the paper also has in the appendix a discussion on the uncertainty, a discussion on how you go about selecting a single point within a range. And because there's various things that tend to clash depending on what accounting basis that you're using and what the motivations of and interests of your principals are and so forth. And what's interesting is that I think there's different guidance provided by different accounting frameworks. So for example, under U.S. GAAP, the idea is that you're supposed to put out your best estimate. Some people have been able to demonstrate to me that best estimate means a mode, means the most likely outcome. But at a minimum, it means that you're not trying to bias the number in either direction. You're just trying to come up with what the number is. In the statutory framework, it's, I think, fair to say, and the paper describes some of the citations of this, but it's fair to say that you also want to come up with your best estimate, but if you want to err conservatively, that can be viewed as being okay, all right? And, of course, in IFRS now, with the move to fair value, that's a whole different type of concept and so forth that we still have to assimilate. But these different bases will create probably a heightened need, an improved need, to communicate effectively and transparently. As far as the variability of the reserves and what the reserve is and what its measurement objective is. So that's the... I didn't notice this was moving either last time. that's an overview of the issue brief. It's not that long. It's maybe, I don't know, 10, 12 pages, maybe a little bit longer than that. It's available or will be very shortly available on the Academy website. Just follow your nose when you get out there. And I think that's pretty much what we wanted to cover. We could take some questions now or take any comments from the audience. And Mark, you have comments as well, or you have slides that we're going to go through. I can try to. I think I heard most of it, but I think the question was, does the issue brief address potential misuse of the range? And the example I think you provided was where you might put a range out and someone may go to the low end of the range and use that, or maybe the range wasn't intended for that purpose. The paper doesn't, we don't address that point specifically. The focus of the paper more is on disclosure of the range so the users understand what they're doing. So if the person that took that range, if they understood that they were grabbing the lowest number and what that actually meant, then that could be up to them. Now, there's other things you can do to protect that from happening or to guard against that or whatever. But that was outside the scope of what the paper was talking about. The main focus of the paper was that the word reserve range gets used all the time, and it was brought up, especially a few years ago, frequently by the SEC and by the accounting profession, by others. And the SEC, in these comment letters, seemed to be searching for something that would be a meaningful disclosure so the users, in picking up the financial statements,
you know, could understand the uncertainty in the reserves. And so some of the disclosures that came out from that you know, would have you know, person, the company might not put a range in, but they might put a few key assumptions with one of their methods and say, if we increase the loss development factor by this and the reserves go up by that, and that might be one line with 1% of the reserves for the company in it. And they might have a couple examples like that. And I can't imagine that that was really, that would really be helpful to anybody. But I think the SEC was just trying to press and press, knowing that companies were resisting putting ranges out. I think companies resisted putting ranges out largely because the word reserve range can have so many different meanings to so many different people that, you know, it would probably create more confusion and more uncertainty than maybe currently exists with the current system. So in brainstorming ourselves to think, hey, gee, is there any suggestion we could provide to the SEC, to the accounting professional, on what disclosures might be meaningful, we thought, let's just take a step back and you know, not try to answer that question first, but you know, get the topic out there. And we tried to get this paper out much more quickly than we did. But get it out there as far as what would be an effective, you know, what would be some of the principles behind a effective communication of a reserve range. So that's what we've tried to address. So, anybody else? We shift to you, Mark.
Well, while Mark's getting ready, I just wanted to add a few comments, and that is that it is an issue brief. It's not a practice note. So what you're getting isn't a how to do a range. It's just an issue brief on the communication, and I think that really the community isn't ready for a practice note quite yet because there are so many different views on how one does these things.
Yeah, that's part of the reason that it took so long for us to come out with this is that we had trouble getting agreement with various steps along the way as to what a issue brief should contain and what the message it should have and what the content should be and so forth. And you'll read it and you'll wonder, boy, that, you know, when we tell you it took 2 years, you'd be like, what's wrong with these people? But it wasn't like that at all. So
yeah, it's not like an ASOP. It's not a binding thing. It's more of a trying to put something behind the issue to help evolve the practice. And I think that's really a good way of putting it, because I know for myself, you know, I've been talking about ranges and distributions for a while, and I know my thoughts have evolved, and being involved in peer reviewing this document really helped as well. And so that's the purpose of me spending a little more time as well, is to think now in a little bit more detail about this reserve range. What could it potentially mean to different people at different times, and to explore that a little bit more, and add some other sort of thoughts to the mix, if you will. I guess I should also say up front that the views expressed here are my own. They're not my employer or the CAS or my family or anybody who's never known me or any of that stuff. While I'm sort of digging more into the technical side of this, I'm trying to keep. I don't think there's any formulas in there like the three bear one that we had a minute ago.
Drake.
Drake equation. So my goal is to keep it at a one bear level too. I thought I'd start with just some more fun things about a reserve range. And I don't know if any of you have ever played either Dictionary or Balderdash. Anybody know what that is? Well, for those of you who don't know, they're both games where you'll find a word that nobody knows in the game, and everyone that's playing tries to define it, right? And then you'll write down the actual definition, and then everybody tries to guess which one's the real definition. It's a lot of fun. Balderdash is actually one of those Milton Bradley games or something. Dictionary, you can just use with a piece of paper and a dictionary. Same idea, though. So I thought I'd give you some thoughts on what might be possible answers if we said, what's a reserve range in a game like that? The first one, portion of a game reserve where animals can roam freely. Section of the cellar designated for private reserve label wines. Range of missiles held in reserve in case of nuclear attack. Description of how royalty behaves when they are in sight of commoners. A term commonly abused by actuaries. I'm not sure which one the right answer is, but Anyway, all right. We really heard some of this already, and I'm trying to sort of focus it a bit more and think about more specifics of what we might consider a range and a distribution and things like that. And I would say that a range is generally considered to be either, you know, a subset of possible outcomes, some subset, right, or a subset of central estimates, if you will, right? I think it could be either of those two things. I think in the context that we've heard, I think that's a fairly reasonable description of what different people would associate with ranges at different times. Now I want to sort of dig into the couple of terms there, possible outcome. That gets used quite a bit here as well in our discussions. And I would say that if you think about the term and try to understand how somebody else might interpret it, possible outcomes should include, you know, the random movements that you would expect to see as a possible. You're saying it's a possible outcome, right? Think about, you know, rolling one die. The possible outcomes are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The estimate 3.5 is not a possible outcome, right? So if you think about a deterministic analysis, right, you've got actual data that's got lots of random noise in it. At the end, you've picked an average link ratio or a selected link ratio, and as you move out into the increment, the future increments, they will have no random noise in there, right? So is that a possible outcome or is it a reasonable possible estimate? I would say it's a possible estimate, right? Now, that's a subtle distinction perhaps, right? Maybe it's something you want to distinguish when you're communicating with your clients or whoever you're communicating with, but those are differences, right? There's a difference there. So the central estimate, I would say, the incremental values are essentially the random movements are averaged or smoothed out somehow, right? So to sort of keep those two distinctions in mind as we sort of think about ranges and distributions and how they sort of have parallels and the differences between them. So a distribution, we're generally trying to describe all possible outcomes, and I put all in quotes there because we're certainly not trying to, you know, get all in the strictest sense, you know, the doomsday scenarios and, you know, the absolute best case. We're really trying to get all reasonably possible outcomes. And that, you've heard that term actually probably in some other things that, you know, in the ASOP discussion this morning, what are the reasonably possible outcomes, right? Well, does that mean it's part of a distribution or is it a reasonable estimate? But anyway, the possible outcomes, that doesn't mean that we're trying to get them all in the strictest sense, but all in the sense that we can reasonably estimate them. Now, a purely statistical distribution would actually include all possible outcomes as defined by that distribution. If you said, okay, I'm going to assume that something is the mean, and I'm going to assume that it, you know, follows a log normal distribution or something like that, and I'm going to calculate percentiles, then you could actually get all, essentially. You know, you could go as far out in the tail as you wanted to. Pick a 9999, you know, as many nines as you want, and you'll get an answer, right? The estimation of unpaid claims, right? There's all kinds of uncertainties there, and so we're not necessarily saying we're getting anything. We're just getting the reasonable estimate of the distribution. So let's sort of keep going. Let's think about the ranges now. If you calculate point estimates, and that's, you know, a taboo term, I guess, now listening through the ASOP 43 discussion, but I'll use it here anyway. But you, let's say you've used those point estimates from the deterministic methods to come up with your range. Now, in the ASOP 43 appendix, it really describes the fact that the central estimate, which is what that's really describing, I didn't use the word central estimate here, we don't really know if we have a mean, median, or mode or estimate, right? By definition, we really don't know whether that is. That's why they use the term central estimate, because we don't really know which of those it is, but it is a central tendency estimate that sort of makes sense. So that's sort of why that term is there, in my opinion. But a distribution will have statistical meaning, and that's where you'll have probabilities associated with the possible outcomes, right? With the probabilities comes the ability to calculate means, modes, medians, and so forth. And I actually found it kind of interesting looking at some of the follow-up discussion of the ASOP 43, where they had a couple of the answers were saying, well, we calculated the central estimate based on expected value of all possible outcomes. I'm like, wait a minute. So they did a statistical distribution outcome? No, they did deterministic estimates. So which I was like, wait a minute, which one do they really intend? And did they not do what they said they were going to do? I don't know how to answer that question, but I thought it was. So let me try to now define sort of several different types of ranges and distributions and try to compare and contrast them and try to bridge the gap between, okay, how do we move from ranges to distributions and how do we sort of bring the two together in different ways. And there, obviously there are very, very different purposes behind them as well. So some of the things a range of reasonable estimates of unpaid claims does. These are things that are actually in the issue brief. It's an aid to management in determining management's best estimate. Like that's sort of one of those common things that's been there for a long time that should not be a surprise. It's used in determining whether or not reported reserves make a reasonable provision. Sort of those key words that you sort of see in different standards of practice and things, but I think that's certainly a fair assessment. It also can be a statement of the reliability of the current earnings. I mean, that's really the sort of the driver behind why we're creating a range. We want to try to get some sense that, yeah, we're giving you a number, but it's not going to be the answer. We know that's not going to be the answer because we're giving an estimate, and there's variability there. It's like saying, you know, on the roll of the dice, you're going to get 3.5. We know it's not going to happen, right? But the reasonable estimate's still 3.5. It's also, I'm jumping into some additional thoughts that may or may not be in the issue brief. It's also based on different views or opinions as to what might be considered reasonable assumptions or methods, right? Think of the example that we just had earlier. We have 13 different answers for the ASOP contest this morning, right? Those are all reasonable, right? They're based on different views and opinions about what's reasonable. And even within your own work, right, you may have differences of opinion about where to draw the line between reasonable and unreasonable. Now here again, I'm actually now sort of making a bit bigger leap here, and in a sense that I'm trying to restrict this definition a little bit further and saying that if it could be intended to only represent those opinions where they're considered reasonable with respect to a central estimate. Now you could take this additional piece up here and say it's a range of reasonable central estimates. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. I'm perfectly happy with that. I mean, just trying to really convey the thoughts and the issues behind what's going on here. Because I want to contrast that with a little bit different range here in a few minutes. But the other thing I think is very important to understand with this type of a range is that it's not readily usable for things like ERM because you don't have any probabilities associated with it. Right? If that's the intended purpose, we heard that over and over again with ASOP 43, if that's your intended purpose, then this type of a range, there's only so far you can go with it. Right? It'll serve a certain purpose in terms of maybe that mean or central estimate of some part of an ERM, but it's completely lacking in the distributional variance issues that you really need to understand the risk elements. A slightly different version now of a range might be a range of possible estimates, right? Slightly different. Now, I just sort of define it here as saying now this is something where we're intended to provide high and low estimates, right? We heard that several times. Well, okay, are you trying to provide a higher or low estimate? You're trying to get more width to this range because you're trying to give them some sense of how bad it could be. Right? Think of scenario type things where you're saying, okay, I'm using a deterministic, but I'm purposely putting in higher low estimates of the link ratios, right? I'm going outside of what I would have considered the reasonable central estimate, in a sense, but it's still a range of these point estimates, right? Scenario testing, various assumptions, lots of different ways you can do that. So I think I said this already, it's really generally intended to be wider than a range of reasonable estimates, although both of them are subjective, right? They're both subjective based on opinion and what's going on with the people that are doing them. Still not readily usable for ERM because we're widening the stance of where we think things could be. And to some extent, to the extent that we're saying some of those highs and lows may be, you know, worst case scenarios or things like that, where we're intended to do something, there's some additional use there, but it still doesn't have a statistical, you know, variance type of a use for that sort of thing. How would we aggregate range? That was actually brought up a little while ago, and I think there's some different issues come in depending on which one of those you're doing. Now, if you're trying to add up line of business ranges, and they are essentially reasonable estimates intended to reflect a mean, and I've sort of switched from central estimate, where in your real intent was to create a mean, and each one of these range estimates could be the mean, then what does that imply when you add them up for the aggregate? Well, the aggregate, no matter what the correlation is, would just be the sum of the ranges, essentially. Right? Now, if they were intended to be the mode or the median, then now you've got a correlation issue to deal with. Right? But that correlation issue sort of depends on what you were intending to grab there. So, and it actually becomes that's much more problematic now when you start thinking about possible estimates where you're outside of that mean focus, right? Now the possible estimate range, how do you correlate it? Now you have to sort of think about correlation in some way so that you wouldn't necessarily want to just add up the endpoints of those and assume that they're all going to go bad at the same time, right? Because now you're intentionally creating estimates that are outside that definition of the mean or trying to get to the mean. I think there's a couple of different ways we can define distributions. And this is sort of based on the methodology that's out there and the types of things that are out there. And it also then has an effect on how you might use them. One subset would be a distribution of statistical outcomes. So this would be estimated using statistical distributions to essentially extend a deterministic central estimate. And probably the most famous example, this is the MAC model. MAC model basically says, the mean is the estimate based on the weighted volume-weighted average link ratios, and we're going to calculate the variance, and then we're going to use assumptions about how to apply the variance to come up with a statistical distribution of the outcomes, right? But it rests on that assumption of the mean, right? Nothing wrong with it, but just understand that it's a little bit different than what I'll describe in a minute, right? Obviously, these are going to generally be based on statistical properties that you estimate through some sort of model, right? Or potentially you just say, okay, I'm going to assume they're log normal, and I'm going to have 10% variance or standard deviation or something. It doesn't necessarily have to be based on that. And I'll contrast that with the distribution of possible outcomes. Now, this is where we're trying to express, and I guess the full breadth of possibilities for the future payouts The distinction here is more compared to the range of possible outcomes where we may not necessarily be trying to get the full breadth. We may or may not be trying to get it, but the distribution of possible outcomes would certainly be trying to get it, and again, within the context of that all in quotes, right, that we're not necessarily getting them all, although statistically, the statistical distribution, the all would be, clearly you could go as far as you needed to go. These would be done using probabilistic models where each iteration of the model would essentially then be a possible outcome. Remember, think back to the earlier definition of possible outcome versus possible estimate, essentially, right? Where you would think that for each estimate or each outcome that you're simulating or modeling, the individual iterations should look reasonably possible, including all the random noise that you would have expected in the past and in the future, right? Or so that's what it gets. That's where, to me, sort of this possible outcomes really sort of takes hold, right? In terms of describing what you've done to somebody else, and that's where you can start to think about, okay, now I can determine a mean and a mode and the percentiles and things like that, and they can certainly be estimated through a variety of models that are out there, anywhere from individual claim models, frequency severity models, semi-aggregated or aggregated claim data, aggregated being the triangles that we're typically used to. Semi-aggregated could be things like average frequencies and average severities. So you're sort of partway in between there. There's lots of literature out there on what things are going on there. And I'm not gonna go into all the models and things of that nature. Now another thing that I think is sometimes when people talk about distributions of possible outcomes, they sort of get the impression that I need to find the model that's going to give me the distribution. And as we saw earlier, it's really not like that at all. It's not intended to be to say, gosh, you should find the model. No model is perfect, right? Some models are better than others. So the goal really is to find the best models and the best distributions that you can use, just like it is the same parallel in the deterministic framework where you're saying, okay, these methods give me reasonable central estimates and I can use them, right? This subset of methods can give me things that I can rely on. Same thing's going on in the modeling world, right? You're trying to find the subset of models that will give you reasonable distributions, right? You can also weight them together, just like you would deterministically. There's, I think, a very interesting parallel that I think people sort of overlook or not, or haven't really thought about enough, maybe, or been exposed to it yet. But you can certainly weight together multiple distributions, just like you can weight together multiple point estimates or central estimates to get your best estimate of the distribution compared to the best estimate of the central estimate. Right? And then we can certainly, there's other analogies where we can define subsets. Remember, I started off by saying sort of different definitions of ranges, where you can say, okay, the subsets and ranges, which could be analogous to the deterministic ranges. And I'll give you some examples of that in a few minutes and more sort of graphically. But you can think of things like confidence intervals and things of that nature where you can actually specifically say that there's a probability that it's going to be in here given the, given your estimate of the distribution. Aggregate distributions. Here's where correlation definitely comes into play. Right? Thinking about aggregating ranges is very problematic. I mean, you could come up with some assumption about it and do something with it. Here now, though, we can determine for the statistical distributions, we can determine the correlation, the aggregate distribution, by correlating the variance of the statistical line of business distributions. For example, if you have the variances from a MAC method for different lines of business, you can say, okay, I'm going to assume they're independent, and I'm going to, the variance of the standard deviation of the aggregate is the sum of the square root of the sum of the squares, assuming independence, or you can add some assumption in there about correlations and take two times the correlation matrix and do that kind of fun stuff. That's fairly directly done. The difficult part, obviously, is calculating the correlation matrix, but which I'm not going to go into here. Same thing can happen with the outcomes, but it's really here now the correlation becomes more an exercise of correlating the individual outcomes that are being simulated rather than calculating it more directly through the statistics of the variances. You're actually saying, okay, we've got these 10,000 iterations for different lines of business. We want to correlate those before we add them together in some manner. Right? So just different approaches that sort of derive really from the way you're coming up with the ranges and distributions. Here's where we really have information, though, for enterprise risk management. Now we have distributions, we have aggregate distributions, right? This is really what you essentially, you know, if we as a profession are going to embrace enterprise risk management, this is, you know, what where the work needs to be done, you know, from the actuarial standpoint. So now I'll give you some graphical things, I think, to think about. Let's just start very simplistically and say this is a range of reasonable estimates, and we can call it a range of reasonable central estimates and so forth. And it's, again, it's really just points on a graph to sort of illustrate the fact that there's really no probabilistic mechanism here. There's no way to say, you know, which one of these is probabilistically the most likely. You know, you're focused on somehow getting the best estimate. And let's say that that's where you ended up with, right? So this black point is your best estimate. And that would, you know, be, a reasonably graphical way of sort of describing how you would go about coming up with your best estimate or best central estimate. Okay? Now, if you were asked to say, okay, I need you to give me more higher and lower areas, you know, I want the range of possible estimates, right? Now we're not focused on that central estimate anymore. We're trying to push the envelope a little bit more and give people more sense of how extreme this could end up. Right, that's a fair request. It's a fair intent, right? But again, I think defining it a little bit differently, saying now these aren't reasonable estimates, saying they're possible estimates because I'm trying to give you more information, I think is a reasonable way of sort of communicating that. We still have the same best estimate, though, right? We haven't really changed anything. Now, with that best estimate, right, you might say, okay, I want to convert that to a confidence interval. So by applying MAC, for example, and there are other examples, Murphy and some others, you could say, okay, I'm going to calculate the variance from the data, and then I'm going to take my best estimate and I'm going to apply statistical application. I'm going to assume this is log normal or whatever it is, and I'm going to take that best estimate. I'm going to calculate these distribution of statistical outcomes. All right? Again, I'm just trying to just throw out some terminology that sort of helps distinguish the process from the and the outcomes from each other. Now, we can contrast that with the distributions of possible outcomes. And here, I think, is where we start to sort of bridge the gap between ranges and distributions. And as I said, you really want to have multiple models. This does not mean that you want to have, probabilistic modeling. You don't want to just say, okay, that's the model, right? There can be several models here, just like in deterministically, that would lead you to reasonable distributions, reasonable possible distributions of possible outcomes, right? And you would similarly, you'd say, this distribution doesn't make any sense because it's too low, and this we know. You could look at it just like and analyze it as you would do deterministically to remove the distributions, the models that are not reasonable. And let's say you end up with these six distributions. Here's where the analogy, I think, comes in. Now you can say, look, with those reasonable distributions, I can actually define now my range of mean estimates. Instead of, they're not point estimates and central estimates anymore, they're actually mean estimates from the distributions I think are all reasonable. Right? So there's sort of one of the parallels there that you can say, even within this framework, there's enough uncertainty and enough judgment going on that, okay, I have a range of mean estimates that's part of defining that there's uncertainty here. In addition to the fact that I'm giving you a distribution, there's uncertainty in the distribution itself, right? And that's an estimate of what the range of mean estimates might be, right? Once you have that range of mean estimates, the other thing you can do is say, all right, I can weight those together. So what I've basically done is say, okay, based on some weighting that you feel is appropriate, by action here or whatever you've gone through, depending on, as you look at the models, there's really, again, a parallel here where you could say, think of the deterministic way you look at an analysis. You say, well, the paid and incurred chain ladder are working for a while because the data is mature enough and, I don't have any reason not to rely on it. But when you get to the current years, what typically happens, I would think, and just based on my experience too, the data is low, you're going to underproject. If its data is high, you're going to overproject. So you throw in a Borneo to Ferguson or a Cape Cod or Berkowitz-Sherman or something else, right, in the last few years, and you give more weight to that because you believe that, the other models aren't as stable in that. And you can do the same thing here, exactly, right? Say, right, I want to blend them together. So that process going on behind would give you this best estimate of a distribution of possible outcomes based on your various models and the range. You still have the range, right, from the original models that you were using to weight those together. And now within this distribution of possible outcomes, you can describe things like best estimate of the mean, best mode, median, percentiles, confidence intervals, and so forth. Right? Any questions? I know I went through that kind of quickly. Any questions for any of the panelists? The issue brief? Yeah. I'll let you guys enter too, but I don't think so. I take that to mean if you're in a deterministic framework, you're trying to define that range of reasonable estimates, as I put it, reasonable central estimates. You're trying to create the central estimates that aren't biased high or low. If there's a bias, you're throwing it out one way or the other. It could also equally apply to the models where you're saying, okay, this model is biased one way or the other because it's giving me too low of an answer or too high of an answer and too extreme of answers. Right, I think it equally applies to both scenarios. You guys,
no, we agree with that. Nothing really to add.
Okay,
good comprehensive answer.
So we're not defined; we're just going through like a 50% probability.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think that may, the question is whether that's directing you to actually try to pick the median or just be an unbiased central estimate, which there's some wiggle room there, I think, you know, because it doesn't says we don't know what it is.
It's only when you define your intended measure to be an actuarial central estimate. It's only then that where that's been defined as one that doesn't have a bias high or low. If you want to define your intended measure in another way, like your mean, median, 75th percentile, whatever, that's fine too, as long as you just define that and you work towards that.
Any other questions? We're well ahead of schedule. Yeah.
One question, Mark. It sounds like what you were doing at the end, it almost seems like some of us old timers are a little worried this is a little bit different than what we're used to doing. But in some ways, it sounds like you're still using multiple methods. You still might use paid loss development and come up with your distribution using curve.
Sure.
Average frequency severity, and then it's still you're doing the weighting that we've always done.
Yeah.
So it's maybe not quite as exotic or different as we're afraid it is.
Well, there's certainly more statistics involved. I mean, sometimes I hear comments that this is just a black, you know, the distributions are a black box, and you know, you're taking all the actuarial judgment away. And I said, no, far to the contrary, really, it's more actuarial judgments required in that world, because now you're commenting really, essentially, not on just the mean. You're sort of putting your stake in the ground, saying, okay, here's a reasonable estimate of the distribution itself, right? Because if that's the intended purpose, is to start thinking about risk-based capital and, you know, how bad things could get in a, you know, to put it into a DFA model and things of that nature, that's what you really need, right? But there's certainly, you know, that all of the diagnostic things you would need for either a deterministic estimate, which we all use, you know, we look at paid to incurred ratios, we look at, you know, lots of different things. Everybody has their own list that they really like, and probably there's a lot of commonality there. Same things still apply in the modeling world, but you also need to think about, you know, other statistical tests that might help you, help guide your judgment even more, and looking at the outcomes and things of that nature, right? Yeah.
Given that the SEC seems to not only support this, but perhaps drove it to some extent, as companies change from, say, a deterministic method to something like this, and their reserves change significantly, and perhaps up and down from year to year as the model is refined, do you anticipate SEC disclosures being fairly specific about exactly how the model changed, or do you think that they're going to be general? We changed our model, and it drove our reserves up 25%.
I'm not sure these guys might have a better – I'm not that close to the SEC, what they might or may not do. But there's, I think, a couple parts to what you just asked. One is, you know, the underlying change in the model, and maybe your modeling is getting better, or you just use new models. I mean, that I think there's certainly parallels there to the deterministic world, because, you know, you may introduce a Berkowitz-Sherman where you didn't before because you see something, and that's certainly possible in the modeling world. The other thing that I think is can be sometimes interesting is that, well, what how can, I think this actually gives you more ability to just explain the fact that there's random noise here. We predicted a number, but we didn't say that it was going to be right, right? That's sort of the untold thing behind the story. We said, you're giving us an estimate, but the thing about it is what we're not saying is that we know it's going to be wrong, right? But now we're telling you how wrong it might be, and having a distribution might be able to say, okay, we were within one standard deviation, you know, so that's not a bad thing to see. It's just the random noise of the claims coming out. This is emerging area of actuarial practice, and, you know, I don't know of anybody that's doing that yet, but it's certainly something we've had clients start talking about. You know, how do we start thinking about that? Because, you know, I get questions all the time from my boss that says, "Well, you predicted it was going to be over here, and now it's over there. What happened? Well, all right, was it statistically relevant or wasn't it? Right? Got to start having those dialogues about, all right, what's the statistics going on, and you know, how does that relate to the central estimate versus the distribution and things like that? I don't know if I answered your question, but
I can make a couple comments. Mentioned the SEC is driving some of this. I mean, the SEC has driven through their comment letters additional disclosure, not necessarily change in the way the recorded amounts are established, right? I mean, they certainly want the process on how recorded amounts are established to be well described and clearly described in the disclosures. And then as far as measuring variability, they haven't been specific enough as to request these models, although my guess is that if a company were to provide disclosure using fairly sophisticated means, I'm sure they wouldn't object. I have not heard anything where companies need to then reconcile later if the size of the range changed from what they had before or anything like that. I haven't heard that being I haven't heard anything to that extent.
But on the other hand, I think if you are changing booked reserves for whatever reason, the SEC is going to want to know. And usually you would say, you know, I've changed book reserves. If it was just random stochastic movement, you would say based on, actual development that we've seen. If it was a change in a model, you would say we've changed booked reserves because we've changed our ability to model, and these are the things, the assumptions that changed. I mean, I think that you would want to make those things pretty clear.
Other questions? No? Well, I'd ask you to please join me in thanking our panelists. Use your way.
Thank you. It's always nice to let people out early, right?
Yes.
Good job.
Yeah, good job. Good job to you, too.
Yes, they are. Thank you. Are those your kids?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cute.
That's a couple years old now.
Yes.
You and Prime, okay. And they thought that.
Without getting into
action,
what do you do?
Yeah, on like on an average, some might get a 10, some get a 0. Right.
So what are some of the, I didn't really hear you say what are some of the things were. I mean, there was the survey.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Okay.
Do you have any suggestions on where they could, I guess,
it's
documentation?
Yeah, Pat listed, she listed a few of those. I think the, we tended to have like what I would call like a threshold issue. So where there was either an awareness or there wasn't, and more often there wasn't. So usually when there wasn't, one, there usually wasn't an intended measure described. The other thing, there's a variety of things that you should be disclosing regarding reinsurance attachment points, how they change, policy limits, and so forth. We may not see them. Most like consultant reports might have had that all along, or a lot of company actuaries, they might have thinner documentation. So the consultant's report probably is pretty close to where it had to be. And remember, people that developed ASOP 36, a lot of them were consultants. So they kind of just say, well, what we're doing, that's good, so we'll make that the standard. So it's really, I think, probably those two areas more than anything. It's the intended measure, it's the document, and the thoroughness of the documentation, making clear that you addressed the various things that are in ASOP 36, the various considerations, and then having, and then just maintaining that record. Do those things.
Okay.
Okay. Hi. Hey, how you doing? Your hair looks a little different from the last time we met. Okay, I was going to say, I now you say that, I recognize you, but you look very different from the last time I saw you, which is a little while ago.
Yeah.
So.
Maybe also with some modeling.
Yeah. And then you're doing the exam this coming year end?
As of
08. So you use that as the scope in.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then after hearing you speak, you're warning of using the model.
We have a form. Yeah, we have a format. Yeah.
All right.
That we follow.
And you maybe it was one that I just read all year.
It could be. Yeah.
But overall, when I read it, it was refreshing. Like, this is thorough, this is good, this is just a high profile exam for the department.
Yeah. Well, this year it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a challenge for you guys. I mean, one of the things that. Are you attending the NASC meeting next week?
No, Steve and Dave are.
Okay. You know, one of the problems is there's only like six mortgage insurance companies or seven. So you can't get anyone's attention. I brought this up a couple of meetings. I brought it up, you know, at CAPF calls like that. But no one seems to really care. But I think that I think that premium deficiency, whether one exists or not, should be part of the opinion. Okay, whether one exists, analysis should be done to demonstrate one does not exist. I think that should be part of the opinion. Because the problem, here's the problem, is that you have this giant contingency here. And most of the times, you know, it would be enough to withstand all kinds of premium deficiency. But if no one does an analysis, there's no way of knowing how much that's getting used up, how much cushion you really have. You know, until, boom, you're off the top.
Yep.
Until things get bad enough, then when it goes off the top, you have no one have a lot of surplus.
Right.
You know, much. Then it's too late to do anything.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people who are struggling with the whole contingency reserve.
That's,
you know,
that's the distribution of you, and then
the same manager
passes.
And then I have a financial analyst over here who's worried about it.
And so I would say
it's totally mechanical. There's no judgment whatsoever.
You know, you look at the S&Ps and it tells you exactly how to do it. So I think those six or seven national carriers, people in these companies know how to do it and understand it. And they really treat it as a surplus. They look at the two together
and like
as
said,
a surplus.
I consider the possibility, okay, maybe it's not normal, maybe it's all normal, and contemplate that also. I think all of that.
The statement that he made suggested that they treat it as a surplus.
You know what, for Gap it is. For Gap, they don't have it, and so did I ever show you my? I don't know if I talked with you on the phone. That might have been to Holmes because he was doing the Texas company. But you know, I'll show you something. Let's say you have a whole bunch of mortgages. Okay, this is time zero. This is years, going out like that, right? So for a block of, for all the mortgages you write in 2008, you're going to earn the premium like this. Okay? You're going to earn the most in the first year, the second most in the second year, the third in the third year, because people prepay and they go in, then they get the default and so forth. The losses, the vast majority of the time, look more like this.
Yes.
Which they peak maybe around year three and year four.
Yeah.
By the time you get to year seven, there's nothing. I mean, it's all gone. And there's usually nothing in the beginning. So what happens is the first year you earn a ton of premium and you don't recognize any loss. There's no defaults. The second year you have a lot of premium and you're starting to get a little bit of defaults. And then by the third year, then it starts to reverse. And that's when all the losses come running in. So you have you're in the Gap world where it's really a mess. You don't have a matching. You earn your premium too fast, and then the losses come in later. So when the industry was making money for 15 years in a row, it didn't really matter. But now we're at a point where this loss curve has shifted up much higher. It's now creating premium deficiencies on the Gap basis, like Radian has one now on the Gap basis. Because you know they don't have enough premium left that they're going to earn to cover the losses.
Okay.
In statutory world, 50 cents on the dollar here goes into that contingency reserve. So that's what makes up the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And when someone says that they view this and their regular surplus together as surplus, I mean, it's what you do on a Gap basis, but it's very aggressive and it's not in touch with the reality of the mismatch. So now the flip side, the 50% contingency reserve goes way overboard the other way. It mismatches much more the other way. So it takes like a mismatch and mismatches much more that way. So it does create a nice cushion. But my suggestion is if you're for this upcoming year end, if there's something you want, if you want the and I don't know how you would do it. I think you would have to ask you might want to at least explore the concept of the company. See if you can get, what their reaction would be to having a premium deficiency being assessed in the context of the opinion, because the contingency reserve can't be part of the opinion because it's just math.
Right.
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 So like you can, you can do whatever you want.
You raised a good point. I would have thought about the premium deficiency reserve.
Right. And they have one on other legal entities.
Okay.
If you look at their other PA domiciled company, that has a premium. That's brain, right. They have brain deficiency.
We'll look at that.
Okay.
And, you know, just for your own information, regardless of how good your work product is, we'll probably still use an outside actuary.
Yeah, that's fine.
The job.
Yeah.
But and I'm kind of in the process of walking with our exam manager and figuring out exactly going to be in that scope. And I think it's going to be a heavy peer review.
Yeah.
Of your methods and assumptions and whatnot. And, you know, it's our hope, and I'm pretty sure that the firm we're going to be using has someone within their firm that's also done.
Yeah, we can recommend various companies. I mean,
the
there aren't too many.
We've got to use our list of approved vendors.
Okay, is Milliman one of the approved vendors?
They are, but see, we have to go in order who's next on the list.
Okay,
and I don't even control that. It's you know, our director who controls, and we have the vendor selected.
Okay. Okay. I'm trying to think, do they do any of these things?
They do, and we researched that.
Okay.
Okay,
good.
See who's opining on that.
As long as they do one, then they'll get the issues. If they don't do any, then it'll be hard.
They do one of the other big companies.
Okay.
But it's
Dynascott, I know more.
Okay.
That's good.
So we're just going to be.
That's really good.
Good.
Yeah.
That's good to hear.
So.
But we just need somebody who's wise and educated in that area to really help us on this, because we're all sort of like, what do we do?
Yeah.
You know, 3 to 5 years ago when they did radio, it was a no-brainer.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole industry was. It was all steady state, so there's nothing to it. Hey, this is Missy from the Pennsylvania Insurance Department.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Dave, he works with me at PwC, and he's joined the Radiant team this year. Radiant's coming up for exam this year.
Okay.
Of all years.
Right.
As of all year, they did go through the 07 report as a scoping.
Yeah,
kind of
replanning.
To figure out what they want to do.
Okay.
See how comfortable we are with
and,
what's being done and helping our examiners.
Yeah. Is it also an exam year for the other entity, Rank, or just Radiant?
They're together. Rating guarantee and insurance.
Okay.
That's what you're calling Rank.
Rank, yes. The insurance, the Radiant insurance one is very hard because there are, it's financial guarantee exposure.
Yes,
That's another one that's, it's where the actuarial opinion is very helpful on the reserve side, because we only look at the case reserves, because that's the way that it works. So, we'll look at that. We've been adding this more.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. And unfortunately, that can leave a lot of surplus. And it should be able to withstand a lot.
I'm just getting the sense that a lot of the financial ratios that our analysts are doing are really going to be meaningless for these companies.
Yeah, they will be. Yeah.
But they don't get that. My analysts who sit in Harrisburg look at stuff, and everything has to fit in the same box. And if it doesn't, then they go crazy, and I'm just trying to help them get comfortable that it's a little different. It's not going to work. Your ratios are going to be wrong because they're reading this.
Right.
So I'm expecting that we're going to have, at some point an actual kickoff meeting.
Okay.
And I always encourage the companies to invite their appointed actuary to come.
Okay.
So.
That sounds good. Yeah, just in the timing of your exam, your review, do you usually start that up in the
we're
spring?
We're starting to, the exam itself is starting before year end. When the actuarial engagement actually begins and commences, that's always subject to change. But we might be in there before year end, too, at least just with some information about it.
Is that
your
arm down?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's not where the department is.
No, Harrisburg.
My father went to college.
He did.
Yeah.
I always wondered if you were originally from Lancaster County.
He was a millionaire.
Exactly.
My father was.
Okay.
Yes. The first overholter that we descended from settled in Lancaster County in 1727.
Okay. Now, the first Griner, which is my husband's family, somebody in the Griner family traced them back 10 generations. The first one who came over from Germany, and he actually bought land from the William Penn Charter.
Okay.
And it's really kind of cool. And it's funny because my father-in-law still lives within 2 miles of where the original Griner tract is from.
Yeah.
And he actually mows for a little tiny Griner cemetery, on somebody's farm property. And
if you go to Lancaster County and you look at the dictionary, it's funny. Look at the dictionary where we are, there's a handful of roles. You go out there, there's like there's a ton of and it wasn't just the one I descended from was the other one. He was.
Okay.
It all came from the same, supposedly the same village in Switzerland.
Oh, okay.
That
many
other Germans were.
Very cool.
The towns all over the place. The whole series. It sounds gone now.